This is a challenge, right? What do I want to say? Maybe that I haven't said before. Really over the last 2 years, I've started to reflect on my own book that I wrote. And I think some of the arguments in the book that I still would sort of strongly endorse, but I think more importantly, some ways in which I'd like to re-engage with the book, as opposed to just sort of, you know, give you a book overview. So what I'd like to do today is take on this this concept that's emerged out of Central Asian studies that I think has greatly influenced the study of international relations, right? No one's really written on this, but I think, Nick Contessi a little bit, but I think this is something that's wide open to really show how multi-vectorism as a foreign policy doctrine, right, is a mode of operating. But to also show, perhaps ironically now, how Central Asian states are going to be increasingly challenged in pursuing multi-vector policies. And then in the last third of the presentation, after I had vowed never to do a Central Asian project again, I'm doing one now, in collaboration with John Heathershaw, and so I want to actually open the conversation again. The title of the conversation is Locating Geopolitics, and it's very much referring to the two parts of the talk. The first part, looking at how geopolitics is conducted in a contemporary, I would argue, multipolar arena. What are some of the markers we should look for? And then reversing things in the end to think about how domestic politics should be regarded in a global era. So the themes of Great Games, Local Rules, I think the overall theme is that the Great Game analogy that was applied, especially after 9/11, to the region is deeply flawed, for many reasons, but primarily because past imperial competition obscures what I find to be very relevant and important for Central Asia, which is it's very much a contemporary window into what politics of a multipolar world looks like. It's a world in which U.S. influence is there, but it's declining, and real separation, I would argue, between hard power and soft power. It's a world where China is rising, not just as an economic power, but as a public goods provider, building pipelines, issuing loans, development assistance. And it's a world in which Russia is leading the normative pushback against Western agendas on so-called values issues, human rights, democracy promotion, and so forth. So many, many themes that have emerged in other parts of the world, I would argue, since the mid-2000s, I think you see reflected very strongly in Central Asia. So the first couple of arguments of the book, the main ones, were that in this period, this intense period, 2001 to 2011, the U.S., China, and Russia all had actually different strategies, and their interactions differed. Sometimes they were competitive, sometimes they were emulative, sometimes one power mimicked the other, sometimes they collaborated, sometimes even on the same issue. And I go into that in the book. And then the second argument was that Central Asian states were not passive in this, right? They weren't acted upon, that they actively managed these interactions, sometimes actively manage perceptions of competition for their own internal benefits, domestic benefits, private benefits, both political and economic. So these two things coming together gives rise in the 2000s to this idea of great multi-vectorism as a driver in Central Asian policy, almost axiomatic. It takes on different themes and different kinds of flavors, right? In Kazakhstan, it's about being center of Eurasia, a global power, multiple pipelines, multiple partners. In Uzbekistan, it accounts for these wild strategic shifts from U.S. partner after 9/11 to then reluctant CSTO member to then withdrawing from the CSTO and once again partnering with the U.S. and a general distrust of regional organizations, right? So while Kazakhstan is integrating in multiple levels into the international system, Uzbekistan is holding up, but both in a kind of multi-vector kind of way. Turkmenistan's this desperate quest for external energy partners, and in fact there you get the swapping of Gazprom, the Russian patron, with CNPC, the Chinese patron. In Tajikistan, it's this steady open door policy within Russian constraints. Like Russia is the primary partner, but then everyone else is welcome too. My point here is that there were actually a set of external conditions that made this so in 2001-2011. The first was U.S. and security partnership post 9/11, that Central Asia became a site for military bases and logistic agreements, post 2008 for the Northern Distribution Network to supply troops in Afghanistan, related security assistance, which some would claim was quid pro quo for this axis, train and equip programs, and then reverse transit plans that also gave rise to negotiations also for quid pro quo. The second factor, I would say, the financial crisis. The financial crisis is what catapults China to the center of the scene, whether it likes it or not, right? Become center stage player economics. And I would say what was then a rather weak Russian strategy for engaging with the region, which I call unite and influence. And so for 10 years, these external forces were in relative equilibrium. They enabled multivectorism. They enabled Central Asian states, all in their own ways, to partner with the U.S., with China, with Russia, and maintain the balance. So let's just talk a little bit about the U.S., the security cooperation, military bases, the NDN. Prior to writing the book, there wasn't a good map out here. Is there? Just the hue here. I guess it's okay. So we constructed one here. And the point being that for the Afghanistan campaign, the U.S. and the West established a number of facilities both close to Afghanistan, but also in proximity to Russian military bases and military facilities. Whether you're looking at Kyrgyzstan, the Manas Transit Center, as it was known back then, next to Sirkan Air Base, which was established 2 years later. The use of Dushanbe Airport by the French for staging flights. Kashi-Khanabad in southern Uzbekistan, from which the U.S. was evicted in 2005. And then, of course, Termez, Uzbekistan, Germany's first overseas military base since World War II. Some interesting Soviet facilities in Mari and in Ashgabat, too. The Northern Distribution Network. This is a remarkable logistical feat that was established by the U.S. So after supply lines were being hit in Pakistan 2006-2007, the plan was to introduce supply over the Eurasian landmass, right? And with branches set up over rail in the Baltic ports, NDN North coming in this way, NDN South through the Black Sea by rail and over. And despite skepticism from people like myself, actually the supply was quite successful in its own terms. Let me give you an example of multivectorism in practice, and this is something written quite a bit about, but it's really Kyrgyzstan, and I would reprise Kyrgyzstan now as to how things are changing. But Kyrgyzstan became base central for about 10, 12 years. It hosted the Manas Transit Center. It hosted the Russian base at Kant. It was the center for transit in and out of Afghanistan and refueling, and it was also the Chinese entrepot for trade within Central Asia. Right? So about four times Kyrgyz GDP used to come through Kyrgyzstan in trade because China would use Kyrgyzstan's WTO status and then re-export into the rest of CIS. So Kyrgyzstan's location made it a multi-vector hub, kind of real estate. Now, of course, the U.S. ran into challenges, right? U.S. policymakers viewed the base as a way to support operations in Afghanistan, almost very procedural. Logistical. Kyrgyz media and opposition saw it as a symbol of U.S. acquiescence to Kyrgyz presidents, their repression and cronyism, especially Akayev and Bakiyev, and the base's status itself was questioned by two regime changes following the political uprisings of 2005-2010. The base itself also became entangled in perceived U.S.-Russian rivalry in the region, although again, there are some variations on this story. The peak politics of this kind of multivectorism was perhaps the base bidding war President Bakiyev initiated in 2009. In that winter, on the wake of the great financial crisis, he agrees to close Manas in exchange for a $2.3 billion Russian aid and investment package. After he receives money, the first Russian tranche, he renegotiates with Americans what was the May 2009 agreement, the latest one. The airbase is renamed the Manas Transit Center. The rent is increased from $17 million to $63 million. But Kyiv has it both ways, right? He gets the Russian money, he gets the American money, this is sort of the kind of typical perception of sort of dealing with both sides. The real controversy in Manas was, however, not the formal payments. It was the service contracts, right? And particularly fuel contracts totaling billions of dollars that were funneled to offshore entities with few corporate histories that had ties first to the Akayev regime and then an investigation into ties with the Bakiyevs. And that was where a lot of the controversy and a lot of the perceived entanglements that the U.S. had in Kyrgyzstan was. Former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates came out with his memoir. He talked about Manas, which is great, so now you don't have to take my word for it. He referred to Manas as amazingly corrupt, as a site of grand extortion, and he said of Mr. Bakiyev, he was, without question, the most unpleasant foreign leader I had to deal with in my years as secretary. China. China's strategy grew out of also wanting to stabilize an adjacent region, but not Afghanistan, its western region of Xinjiang, right? Its Central Asian strategy was inside out almost, that wanting to connect Xinjiang to Central Asia, wanting to develop Xinjiang's neighbors, wanting to stabilize the border, wanting to secure Central Asian energy supplies. And all of this multilateralized its activities via the SEO. So China actually established an international regional organization to conduct these and to sort of put a multilateral face on it, something which causes researchers, you know, great confusion when the Chinese say, that's an SEO initiative. And you're like, really? Are you sure it's not a Chinese initiative? No, it's an SEO initiative. And then you sort of try and figure it out. Very confusing. But the main strategic driver remains Xinjiang. It's avoiding neighboring political stability or chaos. This is the way China looks at the Central Asia map, and it sees borders with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan in its most restive, sensitive province. When do Russia and China swap roles, so to speak, as the region's most important economic power? It is the financial crisis. This is total trade with the region. And in 2009, they swapped. Now, they're both much higher than they were before. And actually, Chinese trade is probably here, right? Because these are official trade statistics from the IMF. Customs officials chronically underreport trade with China. But China is really thrust into this leading role. Later. China also actually builds pipelines. We have a lot of pipeline conferences here in New York and Washington, D.C. Talk about all the great pipelines that are going to be built. Well, China actually built two in this time period, natural gas pipeline, which now is also going to have a branch D, and the oil pipeline across Kazakhstan. And then Russia. Russia. What did Russia try and do in the 2000s? Well, a lot of Russian behavior was actually, I would argue, more socially driven than materially driven. It was driven by wanting to preserve its status as the region's primary power, right? And so this is what actually explains Russia taking sometimes very contradictory approaches to Central Asia. Following 9/11, President Putin calls President Bush. He's the first world leader to do so. He offers support, offers maps to Afghanistan, intelligence, agrees to... Maybe it wasn't his choice to make, but certainly he agrees to the U.S. basing presence in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. Within 18 months, though, Russian perception of what the U.S. is doing has changed, right? From conducting the war in Afghanistan, Russia now fears that the U.S. is there to stay, that it's there to influence. The Color Revolutions come along, and there's a broad perception that the U.S. Really is engaged in also domestic political activity here. So Russia wants to lock in its influence. It starts to pioneer new types of security organizations, the CSTO in the economy, the Eurasec Customs Union, now the Eurasia Union. And I think most importantly, it wants to speak on behalf of the Central Asian states, right, in global fora in terms of formulating security policy and so forth. And again, when you look at the map from the Russian perspective in this kind of defensive competitive mode, right, you do see encirclement in Russia's sort of interest by the West, or at least Russian policymakers claim. So what changes? What changes? I would argue 2014. A aggregation of different geopolitical events that hit in 2014 start to alter geopolitical dynamics in the region. Right? 2014 is itself, it's almost on its own, it's a meaningless concept, right? If you had told me 2012, well, what's going to be different in 2014? What would be different materially? Nothing. Yet something strange happened, right? With the perception of a looming withdrawal of the U.S. in 2014, numerous governments, organizations, NGOs, companies,
in the private sector start taking stock. Well, what does this mean? What's the region going to look like? What's our strategy? Who are our competitors? What's China going to do? What's Russia going to do? What's the U.S. going to do? It's actually remarkable to witness this in 2013, 2014, this moment of decision-making and strategic reassessment. This is coupled with three actual geopolitical events. The first is the perception anticipation of a changed security dynamic without the U.S., right? The U.S. announces its withdrawing in 2014, or will begin the drawdown. There is a link between the U.S. Announcing an East Asian rebalance, or the pivot to East Asia, and it withdrawing from Central Asia. So this is why you start getting, for example, countries like the Balts complaining that they're being abandoned in Eurasia for the Philippines, kind of strange connections to be made. But you know what? When you're a world superpower and you announce that you're going to pivot somewhere, it means you're pivoting away from somewhere. Right? And I think that was an unintended consequence. So the East Asian pivot is number two. The Ukraine crisis is number three. Right? These three events together initiate a really calculated strategic readjustment for all actors. So where do we see multi-vectorism losing its spin? Again, this is not on the demand side. The Central Asian states want multiple partnerships, with, I would say, one exception at the moment. The U.S. is perceived as retrenching. I know President Obama's speech got in the way this morning. But whatever the commitment, whatever the extension of the timeline, there is a perception that the U.S. really isn't interested in Afghanistan. And if it's going to hold on, it's going to hold on really to avoid things going to chaos. But it's not engaged in the deep sense that it was before. We now have a much more robust Chinese plan to march westward that I'll get into. And now I think we have a clear shift in Russian strategy that I would argue was a function of 2014 and also amplified by the Ukrainian crisis, which is going from having this soft sphere of influence to actually creating a network of client states, right? All this means that this multi-vector equilibrium is challenged, that states want multi-vectorism, but maintaining external balance is going to be increasingly difficult and challenging in this environment. So I'll just go through these quickly. I think the question, you'll have a U.S. interest panel. What is the U.S. interest in Central Asia? I think there's broad perceptions that the U.S. doesn't have a great deal of interest anymore in Central Asia. Certainly on the security front, not the way it did. In terms of the Silk Route, right? We can promote the Silk Route, and that'll give us sort of an economic footprint in the region. Well, what we've seen is a lot of, you know, U.S. influence and U.S. policies haven't really translated into greater sort of economic activity and development. NDN was sort of mixed with plans for economic development. It actually didn't work that way. There was a conflation of rent seeking and transit fees with economic development. So actually NDN actually encouraged more sort of border controls in some ways. And really, the Silk Route doesn't address what's, for me, is the number one economic challenge in the region, the challenge of regional capital flight and kleptocracy, right? It's not so much a connectivity problem. It's that the money just doesn't stay in the region. What about political values? U.S. much diminished in terms of its credibility as setting the agenda on values, on democracy and human rights. Ed Schatz's focus groups here on views about human rights and liberalism and democracy, I think, are very telling that when the source of a positive statement of democracy of human rights is varied and it comes from the U.S. president or the U.S. ambassador, supporting these focus groups goes way down. And I think that's, I think, captures somewhat what I think has been real damage to U.S. as a values champion in the region. For a number of different reasons that I'm happy to get into in Q&A. Some of them the U.S.'s fault, some of them a function of the media environment, and some of them the function of political calculations. So what does this new Chinese policy look like? Well, some have quoted this new march westward, the Wang Jishi influential think tanker, as sort of driving this policy. Jishi's paper emphasizes that China needs to get out of this competitive box that the pivot is putting China in, this competitive relationship with the U.S. And actually, if it were to march westward and increase its engagement and its investment, that it could actually find areas of collaboration with the U.S. Interestingly enough, nowhere in the English translation anyway does Jishi refer to Russia. He talks about West as this sort of unclaimed, open sort of area that China can collaborate with the U.S. Russia's never there in this sort of account. And then at Nazarbayev University in November 2013, the announcement by the Chinese premier of the One Route, One Belt initiative, an unprecedented initiative to connect Xinjiang to multiple outside routes, connect Europe and Asia and the Middle East via Central Asia. Also at the same time, last 2 years, a real increase in engagement of China with Afghanistan. Not troops on the ground, and they never will do that, but increased economic assistance and training, facilitating Afghanistan conflict mediation informally, and using Pakistan as its client intermediary to forge ties. So you also see Chinese reactions to perceptions of a U.S. Security vacuum. So OBOR itself is remarkable. It's comprised of a land belt, roads, rails, telecoms, pipelines, promises of hundreds of billions of dollars of investment, also a maritime belt with port upgrades, and an attempt to fill what McKinsey has called Asia's $8 trillion infrastructure gap. There's international and domestic imperatives. We talk a lot about the geopolitics, but actually the domestic imperatives are just as important. China is slowing down economically. Its industries are at overcapacity. Cement, steel all need new outlets, and OBOR, just as I would argue the war on terror, provided this umbrella for lots of domestic interests here to engage and contract and provide their services and so forth. I think OBOR will have a very similar function in China, in that a lot of domestic interests will justify what they want to do in terms of this strategic initiative. South China Morning Post called this the most significant and far-reaching project the nation has ever put forward. Just in 2014, there was an announcement of three new regional funds devoted to this, right? This one's the People's Bank. This is actually quite interesting. And the Silk Route Fund dedicated to Central Asia and AFPAC is actually controlled by the central bank in China, which also gets at some of these ideas that maybe it's more internal than external in some sort of Chinese thinking. Of course, the BRICS Bank, New Development Bank, and the AIIB, all the Central Asian states except Kyrgyzstan applied to join the AIIB, right? And of course, we have the big policy back and forth here. The U.S. encourages its allies not to join because the bank doesn't have standards. Its allies join anyway. I think it's poorly handled on Washington's part and actually diminishes its credibility and influence. But these vehicles are all now on the books. They're all there now, ready to implement these hundreds of billions of dollars projects. So what's this meant to do? Here's one map, right, from Xinhua. I think what's important here in the land route, how central Asia is to these plans of connectivity, also the maritime route there. And the central bank has, and actually the Wall Street Journal has done a really nice mock-up, including the energy pipelines that we saw earlier and these proposed routes. And again, you see the hub going through Central Asia. I'm skeptical. And I'm skeptical because Chinese assumptions about development very much mirror their assumptions about what's going to bring political stability in Xinjiang, right? And this belief in infrastructure upgrades, modernization, right? And so the question becomes, as some of you have heard before, is development a hardware problem or a software problem, right? Are there actually reasons that we don't have better infrastructure in Central Asia already? And I ask everyone to do the following thought experiment. If the U.S. were to announce tomorrow that we're going to pour in $47 billion to upgrade Pakistan's electricity generating plants and roads, how would you react? You think, would you say, wow, this is a game changer. The Americans they're really serious about this. Or would you say, is Pakistan going to have the absorption capacity for this? Right? Is there really $47 billion worth of projects to go after? Yet when China announces it, right, there's this kind of broad sort of gasp, like China's remaking the map. Maybe they are. But I think part of the problem that China is going to face, exactly because OBOR is driven by these domestic constituencies, is that a lot of these funds are going to run into some serious governance challenges. Just to make the case again, time required for import-export between 2006-2014, right? Central Asian import-export times are very, very high. They're the highest in the world, right? 104 days to import and export. Uzbekistan's improved somewhat on the export times, but everyone else, the changes have been minimal. Despite new Silk Routes, despite NDN, despite Chinese initiatives and the SCO, despite Russian-led initiatives. In terms of formal trade, Central Asia really is the most trade-unfriendly place in the world, right? Here are the comparatives. Eastern Europe, Latin America, Caribbean, MENA, South Asia. This is Central Asia here. Notice Turkmenistan's not even in the data, right? So if you're going to build a new Silk Route here, you're going to face real challenges. And I think the only point I would make is that, yes, there will be certain shipments that go through, right? There will be efficiencies. That Kazakh-Europe line will be used. The question is, what other kinds of microbehaviors are they going to displace, right? I mean, I think that's the critical kind of issue. So let me talk about Russia. I know I'm in D.C. Maybe this is heresy. I don't know. But I don't think Russia is resurrecting the Soviet Union. I think it's a dangerous way to think about Russian strategy. It conflates Russian aggression with nostalgia, a kind of myth-making. Confuses, I think, grand strategy with political opportunism. What I think is happening is that Russia is actually focusing its strategy to much better effect, better effective effect than it did before. Russia in the 2000s, as it reengaged with Central Asia, and really the critical time here is 98-99 under Putin, as it reengages with Central Asia, it also is very careful to try and be everything to everyone. Right? It wants all the Central Asian states to sign up to its regional organizations. It wants to mediate relations. It wants to have different fora. And there's a sense that the symbolism starts to trump the efficacy of some of these organizations. Right? Note Uzbekistan's holdup of the CSTO's Rapid Reaction Force. Right? CSTO can't do the Rapid Reaction Force because of Uzbek objections. Right? But Russia doesn't want Uzbekistan to leave. It's important that symbolic it's there. Well, Uzbekistan leaves in 2012, and actually, some of these organizations start gaining a lot more coherence. What I see is that Russian strategy now, maybe out of weakness, maybe out of perceptions of U.S. leaving, are starting to target a number of the smaller states in an effort to create formal political and economic clients out of them, right? That Russia is looking at Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, I would argue, and Tajikistan, trying to deepen its control over them, trying to bring them in Russian-initiated economic and security organizations, trying to limit their outside options. And this is all in the context of trying to generate this regional opposition to Western counterparts and international rules. So I know this is deeply problematic in many ways, but I would actually argue low levels of Afghanistan's instability play into Russia's regional objectives, right? So it gives Russian bases in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan an actual operational purpose. Before, in the 2000s, what does the 201st in Dushanbe do? You'd get different answers. What are you doing in Khan? Stability operations. But there's another base 70 kilometers of reduced stability operations. There wasn't any kind of agreement on what those bases in Central Asia are doing. Now there is. Now they have a strategic rationale, right? They are guarding against spillover, insecurity, instability from Afghanistan, or at least that's the claim. That's the justification for Russia pushing to get back on the Tajik border, right, to upgrade its presence, send helicopters, and so forth. Actually, this also gives Russia a justification to increase border and security cooperation with the non-CSTO countries, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Again, playing the Afghan card. And always useful, criticize U.S.-led interventions and regional consequences. See, the West went into Afghanistan, it broke it, it messed things up, now we have to clean up your mess. So, actually, this post-2014 environment works, I would say, pretty well with Russian objectives. Presented this when I was giving another talk in D.C. in June. This was Gallup data that was mashed up by RFE. Eurasian approval of Russian leadership. So we might think that post-Ukraine, there are concerns that the Central Asian states have, especially after comments made, especially about Kazakhstan not being a real state till Nazarbayev was there, that you might have a Ukraine crisis scenario in Central Asia, and the Central Asian states would want to tilt away from Russia, right? Also, the economic situation's a mess, right? Ruble is collapsing. Migrant remittances are down in terms of the real value, the ones that can still get in. The counter sanctions are also having an impact. Borders are going back up between Kazakhstan and Russia on some of this trade. So you might also think that's contributing to a negative perception of Russia. Maybe I did, and we would be 180% wrong. That approval for Russian leadership in Central Asia now is extraordinarily high. Yes, public opinion is always problematic. But let's look at the comps here, because I think they're compelling. 6% approval in Ukraine, 7 in Poland, 8 in Kosovo, 11 in Germany. All that sounds right to me. Georgia, 16. Tajikistan, 93. Kyrgyzstan, 79. Kazakhstan, 72. Armenia, 66. Even Uzbekistan, 62. What is going on? What is going on? This is flummoxing, I think, some Western policy officials. I would say three kind of factors here. One, the Russian media space is very effective portraying the Ukraine crisis, that actually there are two different lessons to be drawn from the Ukraine crisis. One is a fear of Russian intervention, right, and violation of sovereignty, but the other is a fear of Maidan. It's a fear of street protests, right? And that's equally important. That's something we don't give enough attention about. The so-called color revolution problem, right? And then I think a genuine belief that at the end of the day, in both economic issues and security issues, Russia will provide the stabilizing role. Right? That's the deeply ingrained narrative. So perhaps over the long term, Russia's influence declines. And I think sort of structurally, it does head that way. Central Asia does go further east. But in the short term, we have to realize that this aggregation of effects in 2014 is actually making Central Asians hungry for more Russian leadership, not less. And again, I put the slide in here. Post-Ukraine 2014, if you're a Central Asian ruler, which do you fear more? Do you fear Russia coming in and amputating something? Or do you fear a Maidan? Or maybe the two are linked. If there is a Maidan, the Russians will come in and amputate something. And for sure, if you're sitting in Dushanbe, I think that Russian military presence looks a lot different now than it did before 2014. I come back to Kyrgyzstan. David Lewis has a superb paper on this called Performing Hegemony, where we've gone from being this multi-vector hub to really performing its new status as a Russian client state. And Marlene and I got at this in a memo we wrote for Pronars a couple of years ago, but across all dimensions, the military dimension, Russia pressuring Kyrgyzstan to not renew for another year to facilitate the U.S. drawdown, the consolidation of military facilities, the introduction of copycat legislation, anti-LGBT laws, the foreign agents laws, the purchase of Kyrgyz gas by Gazprom for a dollar, assuming all of that debt, all that burden. Why would you want to purchase an asset? Well, for political reasons, right? Investment in Kambarata and so forth and so forth. There's almost a sense, and Lewis makes this point, that both sides are very eager to demonstrate sort of the classic nature of a political client relationship. So what does all this mean? Does this mean that the kind of argument that I made in Great Games is actually falling apart? I'd hope not. But I think we need to reflect on it. And the way I would, or I'm thinking about it, is that it's not so much that multivectorism is no longer appreciated. It's that I actually think the geopolitical challenge of the Central Asian states is going to be to try and be multi-vector and to try and gain options to diversify away from what's mounting Russian and Chinese engagement, some would call hierarchy in the region, right? And I think that's the challenge. Where does that third vector come from? If it's not the U.S., I think the EU brings up all sorts of challenges that we can talk about. Some have argued maybe it's East Asia, but that's the challenge that the Central Asian states find themselves in. My last 5-10 minutes here, and I apologize for going over, I want to come back to the next project. And the next project is really the inverse of the first project. That I think through this period of geopolitical intrigue on the comparative politics front, things have been relatively static. Now, I think there's some tremendous books out there on Central Asian authoritarianism, patrimonialism, Ed's work on these systems, the great work by Larry Markowitz on the lootability and the movability of resources and the patronage networks that creates for security services. Eric McGlinchey's book on patronage systems and authoritarianism. Jones and Long on the resource curse in this area. All these are really great work. But I think there's also a sense in which we've neglected the global context of where these trends in Central Asian politics are taking place, right? When we say that there's no alternative to President X in country X or country Y, is it there's no alternative in the country? Might there have been alternatives and those alternatives are no longer residing in the country or even in the region? What we start to get is a sense that Central Asian political opposition, political contestation, legal maneuvering is increasingly taking place in places like London, in Paris, even in the States, more so and more robustly so than the region itself. So together, John Heathershaw, now we're exploring this in a new book for Yale University Press. And we start off our argument, and this was also covered in the offshore Central Asia issue, as we really want to tackle three myths of Central Asian domestic politics, right? First is this myth of global isolation related to the lack of connectivity, right? This idea that Central Asia is isolated, right? It's over there. They need to be integrated in the international system. There's immense integration we'd like to show, not only through labor markets, not only through international finance, but a whole cadre of interlocutors, brokers, lawyers, accountants, go-betweens who facilitate these forms of international integration. Perhaps not the ones we'd like to see, but certainly there. There's a myth of partial or incomplete economic liberalization, the failed liberalization in the region. We don't see it that way. We see countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan as having liberalized extensively. In fact, that's why in a place like Tajikistan, you have 65% of GDP capital flight the last 2 years, right? Just a massively disturbing statistic, right? To get capital out, you need to be liberalized. Or how about the story of Asia Universal Bank in Kyrgyzstan that turned into, according to Global Witness, a money laundry for a number of correspondent accounts all over the world, trillions of dollars funneled in through AUB, all with a board that consisted of a number of key Western representatives. So we don't think this is about the failure of liberalization. This is actually liberalization running amok in a place that did not have the same regulatory apparatus and external kinds of pulls as Eastern Europe did. Then I think there's the myth of traditionalism. I'm not going to replay the clan debate, right? Central Asian clan dynamics and so forth. I think it's a very interesting debate, and some of you here in the audience have contributed to that. I think my take on it is this myth of sort of traditionalism is nested in these global dynamics, right? That these Central Asian elites are as much global citizens as they are local citizens, right? They have residencies in our world capitals as much as they do in their particular region, and they behave accordingly. So this opens us, I would argue, to a much richer, much more dynamic, much more interactive understanding of how political competition and contestation happens in Central Asia. Yes, there is what happens in the region, in Kazakhstan itself, in Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and these are all important trends, looking at formal party formation, political competition, if and where it exists, elections, and so forth. But much more important is the interaction between the two. Let me give you some examples before I conclude. This gentleman, case of Mukhtar Ablyazov, one of our cases. Two completely different narrative regarding Ablyazov and who he is. To the Kazakh government, he is at the center of a massive BTA bank fraud, allegations of embezzling billions and billions of dollars, possibly up to $10 billion, the biggest financial scandal of the year. And having looked at a lot of these arbitration transcripts, I'm inclined to think Mr. Ablyazov probably did embezzle a lot of money. What's undisputable is that he's been found in contempt by the UK High Court for failing to disclose his assets, right, as part of a summary sort of court judgment. That's one narrative, right? And so Kazakhstan is now using all of its those legal means to try and bring Mr. Ablyazov back justice. Then there's the counter-narrative,
The counter narrative is that Mr. Ablyasov is a democratic champion. While he was in exile, he allegedly supported opposition media and party organizations, that he was intimately involved in orchestrating political developments in Kazakhstan. These are two very different narratives, but I think they also show the real external, internal tension that's going on here. I'm actually even perfectly willing to accept that Mr. Ablyasov did all of these things. What makes me curious as a scholar is why the Kazakh government would marshal so many resources from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to make Ablyasov's criminal case a foreign policy issue. Right? That to me is analytically really interesting. Right? So prior to 2013, there had been three powers in the world that had engaged in extraordinary renditions to Central Asia. The U.S. and the CIA from 2001 to 2004, Russia and China had all rendered and cooperated Central Asian security services. 2013, we added Italy to the list, right? When Italian authorities cooperated with Kazakh officials and diplomats to send Ablyasov's wife and daughter back to Kazakhstan, and the UN said this was an extraordinary rendition, they were returned, and so forth. So to me, the politics surrounding what's internal, what's external, right? What's legitimate foreign policy conduct? What's criminal conduct? What should be the tools? This is all very interesting, very fertile, and I think provides some very difficult questions for us researchers to consider. Perhaps you're more familiar with this case, right? This is President Karimov's daughter. One of his daughters, Gulnara Karimova, who has been recently implicated in a series of telecom scandals and related investigations regarding bribes, especially in the Telia Sonara case, but also MTS. What's fascinating here is the potential, because it's all circumstantial, but the potential, again, external, internal linkage, right? That as the scandal breaks, as it's spread, we have subject to money laundering probes in the U.S. now, Switzerland, France, and Sweden. She is recalled from her post as ambassador to Spain. She goes back to Tashkent. She's placed under house arrest and supposedly is now involved in an internal struggle with the head of National Security Services. And at some point, she's then appealing, supposedly in social media, to Western media as a human rights defender and champion. Now, I think the counterfactual to ask ourselves, if we could find it out, because it's so difficult to do research in Uzbekistan, would this have happened if we hadn't had these external money laundering probes launched? I think it's a legitimate question to think about. But again, I think it points to potentially this global, local, power political dimension. Central Asian politics goes offshore. Talco, responsible for over half of Tajikistan's export earnings, Tajikistan Aluminum Company, actually it's managing operational core is registered here in the British Virgin Islands, right? And has been the subject of great criticism from the IMF and World Bank for not being transparent in terms of what happens in its books, how many people it actually employs, and so forth. What's interesting about Talco is that in this particular company has also been the subject of one of the most expensive legal cases in UK court history. Nearly £100 million in legal fees expended between former managers of Talco and current ones. Eventually they settled after sort of 3-year litigation. But the battle for Talco was actually fought in London. And now I'm wrapping up. I think the final kind of analytical question I ask myself is, what then is the nature of Central Asian civil society? Where is its strength? Where is its networks? And traditionally, we've, you know, following Keck and Sikink, we think of sort of NGOs as being driven by principles, commitments to liberal values, that they connect with their counterparts in the West, with friendly governments, with IOs. They boomerang around. They put pressure on governments. Those aren't the trends I'm seeing. The trends I'm seeing in the region is that civil society is extraordinarily weak. It's becoming weaker. It's being cracked down upon. It's being repressed. You have this copycat legislation. Even a place like Kyrgyzstan, yes, there is civil society in Kyrgyzstan, but it is increasingly under assault. Whether it's going to survive another 5 years, I don't know in any meaningful way. And you've seen similar anti-NGO bills introduced in every Central Asian country.
where I would argue you have many more robust transnational ties are at the level of Central Asian elites themselves. Actually, you want robust transnational civil society? Look at Central Asian elites. Look at Lola Karimova. Involved in international charity, a diplomat to the UNESCO. This is a 2000 gala. She's here with a famous French actor at her charity launch in Paris. Right? These are the robust networks that they've immersed themselves in. So, borrowing from sort of Steve Kotkin's term that he used to explain sort of dissidents in the Soviet Union, I think we need to ask ourselves, these global connections, who are they empowering? On what terms? Who are they supporting? So just to conclude, I think Central Asian politics is constantly in a process of flux and of being relocated. Relocated geographically, relocated conceptually. And on the one hand, I think it provides a wonderful laboratory to look at sort of multipolar politics in a setting. But I also think that the kind of era of obvious multivectorism might be declining. But I think the reverse now is also a very exciting research agenda, right? The idea that Central Asian domestic politics are not isolated, that it's increasingly implicating global networks, institutions, and social sectors, and that perhaps we just haven't been looking in many of the right places. So I'm gonna leave it at that, but before I do, I'm just one final kind of plea to the audience, and especially to the younger Central Asian scholars who are here. You know, in some ways, I shouldn't be giving this keynote here, right? Sort of to my thoughts about the region. And it's my hope that, and seeing the quality of scholarship now coming out is tremendous. I want to encourage all of you to not only pursue your own research projects and apply them to the disciplines, but to take on the disciplines, right? There's nothing sacred about political science and these international, domestic kinds of comparison. Apply, but also push the boundaries. Reformulate. Reconceptualize. I think the field really needs you, and it needs you to re-engage anew with some of these very basic concepts that we in the West, they serve some purposes, but also we start to take for granted, and I think we need to be shaken up as well. So with that, I'll conclude. I apologize for going over time. Very happy to take any questions or criticisms you might have.
David Abramson, State Department. Thank you very much, Alex. That was a great presentation. I just want to respond to your final point in the talk. Given the point about that Central Asian politics are not isolated, given that you've been looking at the whole offshoreization networks and processes, how do you think that is changing the dynamics of politics in the region? Now, I can tell you, you've given some cases up there, and I can offer my own sense of what is happening domestically in some of these countries.
Yeah.
But what is the external, medium to longer term effect of this globalization, economics and politics?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, you know, and I'll try to answer substantively, although, you know, again, it's sort of early days to conceptually grasp with it. Let's just do Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, right? And let's think about the coming transition. At some point, there will be a transition. Really? I promise you. you know, it has to happen. And let's think about their very different structures in terms of this external global engagement. So in Kazakhstan, we have dozens, hundreds of Kazakh officials, business people, entrepreneurs who have second residences, who live overseas, who keep their assets overseas, right? So according to my own research, the UK investment tier one visa program introduced in 2009, actually, a lot of OECD countries introduce these, right? We give you citizenship or residency if you invest a certain amount. So Kazakhs were the sixth largest recipients of tier one investors' visas in the UK at the time, after China and Russia, number one, and Saudi Arabia and India, and Egypt rather, Kazakhstan's there. Actually, Kazakhstan's ahead of India, right? 41. So you have this cohort, and they are a society, and they are a network, and they go back and forth. The Kazakh government actually encourages this in some ways with programs like the Balashak. They want global citizens. They want them to pick up best skills and practices and be cosmopolitan and so forth. So my read on this is that in any kind of political transition, I think this group of elite is going to be relatively safe, right? Because they do have multiple residences, multiple identities, easy exit options. And I think curtailing this kind of system would be political suicide for whoever the successor to Nazarbayev would be, right? Uzbekistan's very different. Uzbekistan, and, you know, Larry could give a much better estimate on this than I can, you probably have a dozen people who can do what I just described that Karimov's doing, or certainly they have to be cleared at the highest level. So Uzbekistan, yes, it's absolutely autarkic, except for the uber elite, which it's not. That, to me, also has deep ramifications, right? Because it means that especially the national security services, right, who run a lot of these operations and offshore, are going to be sort of central and are going to want to sort of uphold these arbitrage kind of sources sort of going forward. So I think they create different kinds of constituents for the political transition. I think also because of that, the question of the Karimov's external money and wealth becomes a political issue in an Uzbek transition, right? And I think sort of in terms of the West, you have to be positioned to deal with it. I'm sure you've thought about this a little bit, that it will become part of the transition politics, right? What do you do with stolen assets overseas? Then in places like Tajikistan, it plays out very differently, right? I mean, it offers a real sort of exit and really no end in sight for this just system of, I think, you know, insecurity and property rights and sort of predation. And so as long as people can get money out in Tajikistan, with the sort of industries that you have there, you know, I don't think things are going to improve economically. So that's just my initial take. Look who's on the outside and how does that play in to these looming challenges? Sir?
Thank you. That was a very exciting presentation, and you tried to connect many dots. My name is Farukh Nazarov. I'm from Central Asian Development Institute. I'm trying to figure out whether it's really multivectorism. Sometimes, right, actually, it forces into thinking that it's more opportunism, it's more conformism to some countries even,
right,
and this is not, in most cases, a well-planned strategy.
Right.
So it holds true even for transition period. If you right, look like at economic development strategies for most of these countries, you can see it's more opportunism based on the prices, like for major commodities, exporting commodities, and the same holds true for politics. And some countries can afford to play around and actually to choose their friends and allies. Some cannot. So can we actually generalize going all the way saying that Central Asia going, I mean, using this multi-vector policy, which sounds very posh, but still, can we really use this term?
Yeah.
And then if it's declining, then what's coming next?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, I mean, those are both great insights and great questions. And I think yes, there was a political circumstance opportunism. I think we like the idea of multi-vectors. Like, you know, we get it. You know, it's empowering. It explains a lot of policy. It offers policymakers in small Central Asian countries a framework to think about what they're doing, right? So it's useful that way. It constitutes the behavior that it describes, right? But, I mean, in trying to point out how precarious 2001-2011 was, I think there were actual geopolitical poles on which this opportunism was founded, right? And dealing with the three biggest powers in the world, that's quite an edifice there. So was it opportunistic? Yeah, it probably was, as with a lot of this, but I think the feedback has sort of penetrated within the MFAs themselves, right? That they conduct themselves in this way and that they would see it as more strategic than opportunistic. But you might well be right in terms of its sort of origins. So no, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a great insight. Thank you. Nabahor and then Sebastian, maybe?
Thank you, Alex. I'm Nabahor Imamo from the Voice of America. Listening to President Obama today talk about the future of the United States and Afghanistan, he said something like, there is emerging Taliban/ISIS threat presence.
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, and we know that he was also referring to the entire region. How big of a factor is ISIS and fight against ISIS in Central Asia, for Central Asia?
Yeah. So I think there are people who are a lot more eminently qualified to discuss the ISIS question threat than I am, and who follow it in much greater detail than I am. I think there's a couple of things going on. One is, there is definitely a history of politicizing, right? The threat of blowback, of Islamic radicalism, of sort of spillover, of justifying political crackdowns and increased surveillance for this. On the other hand, I get a sense of urgency from sort of Central Asian foreign policy sectors that it's sort of like the boy who cried wolf, right? That this time they really are concerned. Right, almost a admission. Yeah, and other times we were sort of. This time we're really concerned, right? And I think, you know, what's going on, you know, the Turkmen-Afghan border is really concerning. I think, you know, readouts from the Tajik-Afghan border are also interesting. We just don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I don't think it stops this being sort of a huge political pinata that's still being used by governments to justify whatever excesses they have. And that's really difficult in the sense of how then do you secure Western engagement with them, right? And some of the Central Asian governments have brought on this dilemma of, you know, do they really mean it this time? What can we offer and so forth, to sort of to what extent? My sense is the difference between any increased U.S. involvement now as opposed to the 2000s is it's going to be, you know, relatively invisible. It's not going to be public, right? We're not going to put another big base in Kashi Khan Abad. Right, we're not going to sort of draw attention to the fact that we're there and that we're doing. It'll be low level, sort of, you know, border stuff, special forces trainings. I mean, that's my sort of initial guess. And in part, it gets to also the U.S.'s baggage in the region. So it's very complex. And I think this gets back then to the Russian role and what's happening in Syria, right, as another kind of generator of another sort of vector on this conflict. And, you know, I just don't have the foggiest. I think we're in really, you know, dangerous and uncharted territories in terms of how all of this situation can break out. So sorry, I don't have a better answer. Yeah. Sebastian?
Thank you. Sebastian Perrault, Central Asia Program here at George Washington University. Thank you so much, Alex, for your, as usually, wonderful presentation. You explained very well the geopolitical changes which have occurred this last year and a half or 2 years, and which are impacting Central Asia. I just would like maybe to raise, three more specific points, three specific changes, and I would be interested in having your opinion on that. First is, to what extent the decrease of oil and gas prices on the global markets can restructure the so-called great games in Central Asia, as Central Asia has often been viewed as a kind of energy provider to foreign countries. The second point is, to what extent the slowdown of the Chinese economy can affect Central Asia and actually the competition and cooperation with Russia and Western countries. And the third point, what about the potential reintegration of Iran on the international arena and on the regional arena? To what extent can so Iran affect Central Asia?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All great questions, and I'm not sure I'm going to have any good answers to them. I think on the oil and gas, I think it is a problem, but I think Western energy companies had already been relatively reluctant For all the sort of, you know, known reasons that we have. Look at sort of the problems that we've been having with TAPI and finding, you know, an actual champion with it. You know, all the problems, of course, in Kashagan, you know, the selling of a stake by a European country to sort of CMPC. So, you know, I mean, I think low energy prices make these kinds of plays, much more risky. And I think, you know, if already the energy factor was in decline, and my, you know, my sense is it was in decline. I think it's even more so now. And Central Asia is not the only region that's going to be hit by this. I mean, Arctic and other areas too. So, I mean, I think that's one thing. Having said that, I think what's going on in energy on the Chinese side is very interesting, right? Because through this sort of network of distribution and export, what we're getting is CNPC is not just piping Turkmen gas to China, it's creating a whole distribution network within Central Asia itself. Now, they don't call it that. They don't want to draw attention to that, right? In part because China is very sensitive to Russian sensitivities. But that's really what you're getting, sort of the kind of overhaul of the whole grid and system by a Chinese company. And so I think that's the other thing that in some ways sort of, you know, Western companies have to attend to. Iran, I don't know yet. I know some people say it's an absolute game changer. It's going to sort of change geopolitics. I personally don't see why. I think some of the hesitancies, I put it this way, have the Central Asian states been reluctant to engage more with Iran because of the sanctions? Has that been the primary driver? I don't think so. I think there are also fears about Iranian engagement, concerns about possible kind of networks and destabilization. I don't think it solves any of the transactional problems that you have on the commerce side. And I think in terms of, again, sort of oil and gas pipeline plays, you know, we're already at capacity. So I'm not seeing how Iran is going to be as big of a geopolitical deal as some people have made it be. I might be totally wrong, though. Right? And sort of can see that. And Russia-China, it's a fascinating relationship, right? I mean, my take is since Ukraine has accelerated this tendency of Russia becoming China's junior partner in the region, right? But China's very good at giving Russia what it needs publicly, which is not humiliating Russia, not criticizing Russia, right? Always talking in the language of partnership, as it does. And then behind the scenes, being really tough negotiators, right? And so I think that's part of the mode here. What I take out of these interactions between Chinese officials and Russian officials regarding what's the relationship between the new Silk Route and the Eurasian Union, what's that going to be? I think the concessions that the Chinese made are largely symbolic. What they say, okay, we'll negotiate with the EU as an entity. Okay. You negotiate as an entity. What, does that mean the Chinese are going to stop doing bilateral deals? I can't even imagine that would ever be the case, right? But for the Russians, it's face-saving, right? It's acknowledging the EU is a player. It's important. The EU will be eligible, perhaps, for some of this financing and infrastructure. But again, I think it's all on China's terms. And it gets back to the point I made that in some ways, the sides want different things, right? Where the neat division of labor breaks down, as you know very well, is when certain, you know, the Russians say, well, we do politics and security. China does economics. Whoever thinks that that's a problem, you're just sort of, you know, in the West trying to sort of stir up trouble kind of thing. Well, yeah, but then you get China leveraging very low Turkmen gas prices in negotiations with Gazprom, right? That's a very concrete way in which it's hurt the Russians materially. So it's not that neat. And I think, you know, the concern is ever present there that China's economic footprint is so big that it's playing de facto political roles. But of course, China will never admit to it publicly. No, sir.
Hi, thanks. Jack Anderson, Washington and Lee University. I had a question about the development of the new Silk Routes coming up. Back on a couple of the maps that you had, it seemed like the routes were drawn through, you know, Central Asia and then across the Caspian for the most part and then through Turkey, rather than crossing the gap of, you know, South Central Russian plains, you know, say going up through Yekaterinburg and Volgograd. I'm just kind of wondering why that is.
The short answer that there's different versions of the map.
Yeah.
Right. And actually some of the first versions of the map didn't have much Russia there at all. right? This is a revised version of the map where Moscow is a stop on the new Silk Route. So, you know, my sense is that this is still being worked out, that this is what I get at, you know, why I think we should look at this, even though it's so tempting to see in these grand strategic kind of Chinese objectives, to think about it from the bottom up, that, you know, really what you're going to get is this constellation of companies and suppliers, including sort of domestic Chinese energy companies competing with each other, but also competition on the province level for transit trade. And this is a key dimension to it, right? Just as these East Coast provinces started to compete for FDI, right, in the 80s and 1990s, now this idea of becoming transit hubs in these various locales, and actually even negotiating with certain countries themselves, I think that'll determine some of the routing on this. But it's very hard to imagine that this is going to sort of, you know, unfold according to sort of preset plan. The only thing we know is that in all of these routes, this kind of Central Asian core, actually Xinjiang, if we want to be more precise, looms very large. And I think that's, I think it's the ultimate bet in some ways that the Chinese are making, right? Not only economically, but politically. And politically, the idea is that greater interaction fosters stability. And there are certain places where we've had opposite reports, northern Myanmar, Baluchistan, and, you know, China doesn't react well to this kind of news reports. So, you know, so I think it's very much in flux. I think the sensitivities of including Russia are real, and the Chinese are aware of that. But ultimately, because this is domestically driven, it doesn't need to be that efficient anyway. Mr. President.
Thanks, Alex, for this great presentation. Lots of food for thought. I think we'll be, you know, thinking about this through the whole conference, which is exactly the idea of a keynote. So thank you. Just very quick, a quick question, and asking maybe to speculate a little bit. I mean, you've painted a picture. You've hinted at some of the hiccups to Chinese ongoing progress, sort of intensifying Chinese involvement in the region, Central Asia in particular. You didn't hint at anything with regard to Russia's.
Yeah.
So I'm the question is really sort of what kinds of things could you anticipate might produce some indigestion for Russian expansion in the region? And I'm thinking, I mean, there may be a number of things you could speculate on, but one thing that comes to mind is, can Russia countenance a Kyrgyzstan that's actually a democratic polity? Kyrgyzstan be a stable client state and be a democracy at the same time? I mean, the recent elections are actually quite encouraging on the about the quality of that democracy. Mm-hmm. One
sure.
could put adjectives in front of it and so on. But it does raise the question of what Russia can countenance on its borders.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great question. And I think, you know, when Russia was pleased to see Bakiyev overthrown, they became democratic champions in the region, right? So, I mean, there is sort of some opportunism there. I think Kyrgyzstan's a different story. And I know I've had disagreements actually with folks in the city about this. I think to really sort of get out of the trap of a client state, you need credible alternatives. What's Kyrgyzstan's credible alternative? Kyrgyzstan to even sign up for the AIIB, right? I mean, there's a sense in which things have changed so quickly in Kyrgyzstan, right? And fundamentally in the last 2-3 years that, sure, in 5-10 years' time, the pendulum may be swings back. You have connections you didn't even realize. You know, maybe Turkey becomes more significant politically in addition to some of these economic links. But I don't see where the alternatives are coming from in terms of Kyrgyzstan. And I think, you know, this recent spat over a scarf is really interesting. It's really telling, right? Because, you know, I'm referring to the, you know, the sort of Kyrgyz, you know, rupture with, you know, the U.S. over the awarding of a prize to the jailed activist human rights defender. You know, that this was exactly in the Kyrgyz political wheelhouse, right? It got at questions of Kyrgyz nationalism, right? On the other hand, too, it pleased Russia in terms of breaking relations with the U.S. over a domestic issue. I mean, that's where the momentum is at the moment. So I think my question to you, back would be, why does Kyrgyz nationalism always construct itself in opposition to almost everything else except Russia? Right? Or it seems like to me. Or, you know, maybe your focus groups that reveal something else. Like, I don't know. Client states are always unstable, and I want to emphasize this. This is not an equilibrium. Maybe 2001, 2011 was an equilibrium, but I think the whole dynamic of you're a client is that you try and threaten to go away, you sort of make some moves, you threaten that you're going to collapse or whatever, because you need some justification to have your patron keep pumping money into you. So I actually think some of that dynamic is inevitable. Now the Kyrgyz have to adjust from being kind of multi-vector to being kind of effective sort of clients to do this. So I think, you know, that's inherent in that kind of tension. But again, you need sources of outside engagement, for that to be credible. And I just don't see where they are now. In 5-10 years time, you know, certainly they might materialize. But yeah, no, I think we're sort of at the end of the line. Yeah, in the back. Actually, just wait for the mic so that everyone can hear. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Vladimir Fedorenko. I'm from the Rethink Institute, and thank you very much for your interesting presentation. In fact, it literally kept me on my feet all the time. My question, I think it's a very interesting issue that you raised about offshore Central Asia.
Yeah.
And the communities living abroad, expatriates. Do you think anytime soon that this community can become a diaspora in a real sense? Because we have a lot of people living outside of the country, but, well, I don't see any significant political presence who can advocate or even protest in an organized manner what is going on in the countries. And do you think, the second part of the question, there is a significant difference in terms of the interpretation on what's going on domestically in the region, regarding to the national policies? Yeah. So there is different informational feed that you hear have within the country and outside. Do you think, yes, it's gonna have social cleavages between understanding between diaspora, and how it's gonna affect the cooperation between diaspora and the people who live?
So this is a fascinating, really important topic that I can give you some preliminary thoughts on. But again, I mean, this is a topic that deserves its own research agenda, right? The emerging diaspora politics here. I think there's one critical, when I think of diaspora politics, there's one critical feature or variable, and that, does the diaspora return regularly, right? If the diaspora returns regularly, right, if they're seamless, if they go in and out, then that's a much more organic relationship with the society and the polity. But if, I would argue, as in the case of Uzbekistan, the diaspora leaves, it's estranged, right? It starts developing its own networks, its own identity, and it holds this kind of mythical notion of what's going on. It also becomes out of touch, and it also becomes illegitimate, you know, at a later sort of transition point. And I think that's part of the tension confronting, I would say, you know, the Uzbek diaspora versus, you know, the Kazakh diaspora, if you want to look at it that way. So in terms of organizing, I think Central Asian rulers live in fear of the diaspora organizing overseas. I think this is, you know, one of their, you know, main motivators, one of the main things that keeps them up at night. When Karimov gives a speech talking about external forces aggregating overseas, right, this is what he's referring to in my mind. Right? The sort of mobilization, potentially, of political opponents, migrant workers, their political activation overseas, which then necessitates the extraterritorial means of cracking down, which can vary. It can be anything from Interpol red notices, you try and do it legally and treat it as a criminal issue, to the use of the Minsk framework and cooperation with security services, to, as we've seen in Sweden, taking matters into your own hands, literally, or contracting someone to do it, right? And on an extraterritorial level. So I actually think the diaspora issue, and we have a chapter of this in the upcoming book with John, provides a new and absolutely pressing political dilemma. Like, how do you go after diasporas? How do you ensure that they don't do what You're asking about the potential. And I think there's different sort of tools that you use. But certainly the political organized and the media is the other one, right? The fears of the media, again, coming back into the region and clamping that down. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is very much part of this kind of global local dynamic. Any question? Please.
Hello. Thank you for the presentation. My name is Malika Tukhmadiyeva. I'm a fellow here, Central Asia Program. Following up this offshore diaspora and globalized Central Asia argument, what do you think about fighters like from Central Asia in the ISIS in Syria right now? How does it add to your argument?
I mean, I think
offshore Central Asia.
Yeah, offshore Central Asia. I mean, I'm not the expert on this, so you know, I don't know what my speculations offer. One thing I would say is I would question seriously the assumption that these fighters return to Central Asia themselves, right? If they've been recruited in places like Turkey, like Russia, Western Europe even, then it might be the case that they're more fluid than we're making them out to be. But certainly, I mean, I think ISIS recruitment, you know, is itself a very global transnational phenomenon, right? It's exactly a product of its time. And so I think, you know, thinking about it just purely in territorialized ways also doesn't allow us to sort of adequately conceptualize. But I think once you've been in these transnational networks and then you're sort of taken out, you know, what exactly is the political calculus of going back home when instead you can go somewhere where you're supposedly needed or mobilized, right? Go to Syria, or then you go to Kurdistan or whatever it is. So I think that would be my main kind of argument, is that I'm not sold on the return, but maybe I'm wrong. Sort of take one in the back and then Doug.
Yeah. Alexandra Dennison from NATO in Belgium. Thank you for your presentation. It's really informative. I just want to explore this idea of China running into governance issues.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is quite an elementary question, so I apologize in advance. But I'm just wondering what, in terms of what you mentioned, they've already been investing. So in terms of a change in this running into governance issues and considering other countries in which they're investing, particularly Pakistan, for instance, and their own governance issues, like, what specifically are you referring to and how do you think this is going to impact future engagement?
Yeah, thanks so much for that question. So I didn't have a chance to include a slide on this, but I mean, the way I think of it is sort of three unintended consequences, and they're all under this kind of broad rubric of governance. One is that you will get the private appropriation of Chinese funds for private purposes amongst Central Asian elites, right? So an example of this, as you mentioned, we already have these behaviors going on, and that's why I would say actually look at Central Asia and some of the track record as an example of things that possibly could go wrong. So think about the Dushanbe-Chanak Highway, right? Built with Chinese money. A few weeks after it opens, toll booths go up. Innovative Road Solutions, registered in the BVI, starts operating the toll booths. The revenue streams go to whoever IRS is affiliated with. You know, there's no corporate history. Now, the Chinese, of course, didn't intend that, right? But this is part of the problem. When you don't impose conditions, right, on how the money is going to be used, you are vulnerable to local elites coming in and taking those funds and using them for their own purposes. I think you're going to get a lot of that. So then the question becomes, does China then actually go to a more kind of monitored type of lending? I think it's a very open question. The second knock-on effect would be displacement. This is what I was getting at, right? It's precisely because there will be protected shipments coming in that customs officials who are used to treating borders as a site of sort of revenue extraction and rent seeking will then go to other sources, right? To me, that's the lesson of NDN. It's not that the shipments got across, it's that the shipments got across and those rates kept being raised, right? It actually, the micro and the macro went in opposite directions, and I think that's the case. And then I think the third unintended consequence will be just a ratcheting effect of the kind of graft that's expected from other sources, right? The Chinese are providing, or there's an expectation that they're providing this pool of wealth, what's that going to do to Indian investment, right? What's that going to do so other external powers are genuinely interested? And, you know, let's face it, in the big infrastructure projects, they're not economically lucrative. They're risky, right? So I think those three categories are privatization of income screens, displacement, ratcheting of graft. Those are the big problems I see. But I absolutely agree with you that it's nothing new. I just think that OBOR, even if it comes in at a fraction of what it's supposed to be, is on a scale way beyond what we've seen yet. Doug, I'll take one and then I'll take one in the back.
Such an interesting talk, Alex. Really wonderful. And it struck me thinking about it that you seem to have a couple of different narratives that you're juggling.
At least.
right? I mean, in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, you have the argument that, okay, the United States is receding somewhat from the region. The West, even Europe, is somewhat remote. That leaves a more hierarchical structure with Russia being able to insert itself fairly cannily. And with China's economic, influence growing enormously, that's really the main question. There is still a lot of hierarchy in the region.
Yes.
On the other hand, you suggested that what's going on at the elite level is something much more subtle, below the radar, that there is a lot of multilateralism. And I guess I want to just push you a little bit on that. You were talking about the stratospheric elite. What about younger people who are increasingly connected on the internet? Do we maybe need to think in terms of not only geopolitics and multivectoralism, but also cultural multivectoralism?
Doug, absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, you've done, you know, really amazing work on this in terms of sort of identity formation and how the filters through which sort of youth see themselves and the productive kind of interplay of that. I guess my framing of this was not to preclude other forms of identity formation and other forms of networks, which I agree in terms of their explosion online is going to be really important. How we study it, I think, is challenging, right? I mean, how do we, you know, again, another great project for young scholars out there, how we kind of measure how the identity impact these online communities, whether they're consequential or not, it's a different story. But what I wanted to do here is point to exactly this bifurcation between kind of classical geopolitical concerns on the one hand and then the social circles in which elites sort of find themselves. And I think that's made possible by the political structures of these places. So the question would be, what are the comparable opportunities to sort of join these global networks? And there are some, But I also think that there's a little bit of sort of class element here, right? So who's going to change? Who's going to send their sons and daughters to elite schools in the UK, right? To here, to the East Coast. We're really talking about, you know, elites and billionaires and oligarchs. And they continue to do it. They do it even more so than they did before, right? They're sort of special gatekeepers you hire to get your real estate in London, and then it'll get you admission into Eton or Highgate or wherever you need to, sort of one-stop shopping kind of thing, right? That's for the very privileged few. I think this is where China becomes an interesting potential. And I was looking over here because Sebastian's written about this, that, China perhaps offers the way out if you want to work yourself up, if you want to be entrepreneurial, if you want to go and make your fortune, then maybe you do leave for Kashgar, right? You do go to Urumqi. You take a plunge into the unknown, into the power that's actually networking and connecting, and maybe that's why it makes sense to have that. But again, I think these are really stratified, and not knowing enough about sort of social trends, I would be surprised if that elite level changes.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm Miriam Baitimbetova and from University of Birmingham. So I have a question about SEO and OBOR. So I was just wondering, so if we're looking at SEO, the origins are from 1995.
Yeah.
And then as the organization in its current state is 2001, and if we're looking at OBOR, the origins are from 2013. So what do you think? Is it just another way for China to have its interests more engaged, especially if we're looking at this map? You can see that, and that's what you emphasize yourself, that the center of the oboe is actually Central Asia and Xinjiang.
Yeah.
So so why do they need to go for the oboe, which is going to be more risky if they already have SCO, and plus India and Pakistan are becoming members?
Right. So that's, I mean, that's a great question, and I actually really appreciate, I think, you know, your insight that, that you've thrown there, which is, you know, why didn't this pan out in the SCO? And the reason is that China and the other countries at heart fundamentally disagreed as to what the SCO was going to be, right? For China, you're right. It did emerge out of the mid-90s, this narrative about cooperation being so successful in the border negotiations that then they found these natural synergies on other types of security issues. And, of course, Chinese officials around 2002, 2003 were making statements how they thought the SCO could be a vehicle for free trade in the region. Well, who else signed up to that? No one, right? And Russia, at every step of the way, in private, has put a check on all SCO expansion projects, right? So two examples, the anti-crisis fund that Beijing wanted to do in 2008, right? So this hits in the region. Beijing says, hey, you know, we should have an infrastructure fund so that we still have investment and upgrades to infrastructure in the region. We'll call it an anti-crisis fund. Let's do $10 billion. Russia says no. Right, Chinese come back in June 2009 and say, okay, you put in $5 billion, we put in $5 billion, right, let's make it work. And then Russia says no, and they cite some law in the Duma about not being involved in multilateral projects, right, clearly thing. So that was one. Then the summit in Beijing a couple of years ago, it seems a done deal that we're going to finally have a regional development bank. Right? That's, you know, it's going to happen, right? They've negotiated it, the details there, the committee structures, and what happens just a few weeks? The Russian delegation says, I think we're going to need some more time to study the technical issues to this, right? And they pull the plug. And that's because Russia doesn't want to confer authority, even though they know what China's doing economically, obviously. They don't want to confer authority or institutionalize a lock-in of Chinese economic power that way. They don't want to do it. So I actually see OBOR in Central Asia. In some ways, it's not the only factor. I think there's so many factors driving OBOR. But in some ways, a little bit of a reaction to that, right? Finally, sort of say just frustration. It's not happening within the SCO. And I think the Chinese are frustrated with that. They're frustrated with, you know, Russian reluctance. They're frustrated, actually, at Central Asian issues, legal issues, and governance issues. So they're going to take matters into their own hands, which is the typical sort of Chinese reaction. In turn, I see that then allowing the organization to expand. Because if it's not problem solving, if it's not actually fostering regional integration, then why not just turn it into a pure prestige project and then let these two very important populist countries also join, right, in this sort of sphere? So I think those might be related too, right? The sort of giving up on it as an economic organ, finally saying, okay, we'll admit India. And of course, if India gets in, Pakistan gets in. So yeah, but I think you're absolutely right to point to that. You know, the SCO in terms of its economic potential never really got going. Yep, please. We go.
Aynur Akhmeteliyeva from Kyrgyzstan, the visiting scholar at the Elliott School. The first question is regarding China's possibility to use its economic strengths to influence domestic political processes in Central Asia. And the second question is, what are the possibilities to connect Central Asia with Southeast Asia within the context of the New Silk Road Initiative of the State Department? Thank you.
All right. No, thank you. What was the first part again? I was thinking Southeast Asia. Like,
About China's influence.
Oh, China's influence. Okay, yes. So it's like taboo, big topic. So I think let me back up. I think there are only a certain of number of times you can say these stories coming out about how Chinese monies are being misused or how Chinese monies are contributing to local conflicts, they're all produced by, you know, NGOs who, Western NGOs who don't like China, right? That's the Chinese line at the moment, right? Sort of op-ed and NY Times. I think there's only so far that's going to go, right? That eventually there will be an identification that this is a problem. It's an issue that the funds are not doing what they're supposed to do and that they're being counterproductive. So then the question becomes, what's then the mechanism, right? The preferred Chinese way is quiet level diplomacy, right? You have a problem, you don't bring it out to the front, you try and deal with it in the back. You know, the way they did actually with Bakiyev in 2005, right? When they made him take the pledge on the sanctity of borders and so forth before he got his banquet. So Chinese are very effective at that kind of thing. I think the question is, do they have blinders to this particular assumption? And I don't know. I think they do in Xinjiang a little bit, because I think, you know, the assumption that more development is going to produce political stability, you know, isn't sort of happening. But I think in these particular cases, I think they might have to make some mid-course adjustments. But whether that's in an institutionalized sort of setting within these political systems, I don't think so. Take it the other way. Let's take from a region that we've had some Chinese backlash against Chinese economic involvement in Africa. I mean, a place like Zambia, for instance, right? Sort of, you have a presidential election where the anti-Chinese copper candidate, right, sort of runs for president. Well, the difference between between Africa and Central Asia on this front is that the incubators of this anti-Chinese statement in Africa are usually NGOs and trade unions, right? Those are the two kind of vehicles of this. Comparatively, these aren't strong in Central Asia, not in the same way, right? And then, in fact, I think, you know, the NGO involvement even on Chinese issues would risk the wrath of all of these governments, for this is sort of taboo. So I don't see what the vehicle is going to be to complain about sort of, you know, Chinese influence on the Central Asian side. On the other side, I think the Chinese are well aware that they're not popular in some countries, right? That there is sort of a sense that sort of concern about them. Maybe something gives and maybe something tweaks. Maybe they have to adjust, but I think they'll keep trying to do it quietly for as long as they can. On Southeast Asia and the new Silk Route, you know, I'm sorry to sort of State Department officials here. I just don't see the new Silk Route as serious. It's not that it's just not serious. I understand why this was put out as an orienting concept, right? And sort of to signal also that you're leaving an Afghanistan connected, more robust, with an agenda. But I also think it incurred some geopolitical consequences, right? Of sort of setting up a geopolitical kind of grand vision for what was going to happen. To me, it just actually magnifies the differences in spending between the U.S. and China in the region. China's going to commit hundreds of billion dollars to its new Silk Route. What are we going to commit? Right? We're going to do CASA 1000, right? And we're going to call TAPI part of the new Silk Route, right? So I guess the point I'm making, it's not costless even to have a slogan. I think, you know, that's just something bearing in mind. But I have a very particular view on this. Yeah. And maybe take one more. There's one in the back. Yep.
Well, thank you so much for a very impressive talk. It gave me a lot of things to think about. My name's Roon Steenberg. I'm from the Harriman Institute.
Why haven't we met?
We've met on the hallway. I just got there. I haven't been there for long.
All right, welcome. It's a very New York kind of moment now. Offshore.
I'd like to follow up on the OBOR question and the question on China's role and the role of Xinjiang in that, right? Also, because you were suggesting that Central Asia might not have the potential for the kind of infrastructural ambitions that the Chinese have in Central Asia. And I think that's an interesting question. I would like to pose two counter questions to that. First of all, whether the potential has to be local per se. So the other actors in the great game, well, Russia might have been reluctant to join in within the frame of the STO, but once the infrastructural projects get going, they might jump on the wagon, so to speak. And the U.S. New Silk Road and Heart of Asia projects that they were part of initiating through Turkey also might also go into that. That's the first question. The second question is it really about whether there's potential locally or not, or, as we see in Xinjiang, as you argue yourself also, might it not be much more about how the Chinese yeah. go about it and how the interaction will be between right. Chinese companies from East China, yeah. Zhejiang especially, right. And the local population? Right. Because we've right. seen some problems in Tajikistan, we've seen some problems yep. with that in Kyrgyzstan also, and yeah. Xinjiang gives the best example. Compare Kashgar Khotan area with the Kumul area in the east, and you'll see two very, very different forms of implementation.
Okay, so let me get back to this NSR. I'm not sure I can put another kind of interpretation on this. I think the dilemma you sort of outline is one that's not easily solvable, right? I think both can be true. I think there's such compelling domestic imperatives why China wants to do this and has to do this, and that sits alongside, I would say, you know, the lack of obvious targets in Central Asia for the spending. And then I guess the question I would ask, is this a productive combination? Right? Or is this rather a recipe for things to really go wrong? Right? And that's what I would say. So I, you know, that would be my take. On Russia, I don't think Russia has the cash to spend in Central Asia. It can talk about things, it can buy Kyrgyz gas. For me, this is why this Russian strategy actually makes sense for them. Because Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, to a certain extent, I think it's going to be more difficult for them in Tajikistan. You know, they can go after them because they have levers after them, and they're relatively sort of small. The other states, much more difficult. And the first thing that went during the financial crisis was Russia's spending commitments in the region, and similarly now, you know, they just don't have the cash to do it. And you know, and until they sort of sort themselves out, I just don't see how they can join meaningfully. The most they can extract are symbolic concessions from the Chinese, which, you know, the Chinese are happy to give them. So then this gets back to sort of how should the U.S. think about sort of, you know, these Chinese efforts? And you say, okay, on the one hand, you know, this is in line with U.S. objectives, right? We're connecting the region, hopefully, you know, encouraging commerce, upgrading the Soviet era infrastructure and so forth. Sure, this is in U.S. interest. But let's go back to the Dushanbe-Chanak Highway. You know, is it in U.S. interest to have this privatized revenue stream accruing to the elite? Maybe or maybe not. Is it in the U.S. interest that actually the Tajik government rejected a World Bank proposal for the same road, right, to get the money from China instead, much like Angola did with the IMF? Ooh, then it's trickier. Then it's trickier. Because then on the one hand, we have the infrastructure. On the other hand, you have the geopolitical element. Right? And what you're getting is what Dan Nexon and I are doing, a set of papers called public good substitution, right? From the bottom up, in which, you know, providing public goods is a hegemonic function if you take someone like Kindleberger or Gilpin seriously. So, you know, I think all of these tensions are there. I think the Chinese are going to have to cope with them. But I also think they're wading into, an area where I think their adaptability is going to be tested. Thanks very much.